Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine, if you will, for just a moment, that you are living in a world where a sudden spiking fever isn't, well, it isn't just a biological malfunction.
Right. It's not a germ.
Exactly. It isn't a virus or, you know, a bacterial infection that you can just treat with a pill. In this world, that fever is a literal invisible entity.
A hostile force.
Yeah. A hostile force that's actively feeding on your life energy, your child's sudden illness, or a devastating flood, or even the violent whims of a local king. They aren't random strokes of bad luck.
They're coordinated attacks.
Coordinated attacks of predatory spirits just wandering the ancient landscape. So how do you protect yourself? Like, what kind of armor do you wear when the end is invisible, malicious, and entirely outside the realm of the physical?
It's a terrifying thought, really.
It is. And today we are opening a door into an ancient Buddhist survival manual that was designed for exactly that reality.
Welcome to our scholarly Dharma lecture.
Glad to be here for this. We are setting a tone today that is deliberately warm, measured, and deeply contemplative. We want to give the profound concepts we're going to explore the space and the time they need to truly resonate with you.
I think that's crucial. It's essential to approach these canonical texts not just as historical artifacts to be quickly cataloged.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
We have to actively inhabit these entirely different landscapes of thought. So today we are looking at a scripture from the Tibetan Kanyur,
which is the massive authoritative collection of the translated words of the Buddha, right?
Exactly. Specifically, this is TO 563 in the Tohoku catalog system. That's a system which helps scholars navigate this enormous canon. The text is the Sutra Great Upholder of the Secret Mantra.
And the Tibetan title for that is Sangrigsjin Purjesud Zinpayim Handa, translated masterfully into English by the Dharma Chakra Translation Committee.
Yes, under the guidance of Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche,
which is part of the monumental ongoing effort by the global nonprofit 84,000. Their mission is to translate the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern languages so that, you know, these ancient survival manuals, these maps of awakening are accessible to the modern world.
And the historical weight of this particular text is just staggering when you consider the hands it has passed through.
Oh, absolutely.
It was translated into Tibetan during the early 9th century, right in the heart of the Tibetan intellectual exchange.
Right. You had a translation team that included the legendary Tibetan translator-editor Bande Yeshe Day,
working side by side with brilliant Indian scholars, people like Shulan Drabodi, Jena Sidhi, and Shika Prabha.
And they were bringing over a corpus of five texts known collectively as the Panyaka, or the Five Protectresses. But here is where we encounter a massive categorization puzzle.
Yeah, so the Tantra classification.
Yeah, and I want to push back on how this text is traditionally understood, because in the Tibetan canon, the five protectresses are filed away in the final section of the Action Tantras.
The Kriya Tantras, right?
Exactly. But anyone reading the Sutra Great Upholder of the Secret Mantra is going to be immediately struck by what is missing. There are no elaborate visualization exercises of multi-armed deities.
None at all.
There are no specialized ritual hand gestures, you know, the mudras. You won't find complex mandala diagrams or secret initiation ceremonies.
It reads fundamentally like a standard Mahayana sutra.
Right. A narrative discourse given by the Buddha. So how did a text completely devoid of standard esoteric ritual machinery end up classified as a tantra?
Well, that tension between the content of the text and its classification, it's one of the most fascinating aspects of Buddhist literary history. To understand the why, we really have to look at the mechanics of how these texts evolved in the real world.
Okay, so how did they evolve?
Well, these five texts of the Panyakaragga did not start as a unified esoteric package. They developed independently. Some of their roots, particularly those found in another text within the group called the Mahamayura, they actually predate the rise of Mahayana Buddhism altogether.
Wow, really? So they're incredibly old.
Incredibly old. And they originated as a highly pragmatic tradition. For the early practitioners, these were essentially public health manuals.
Public health manuals.
Yes, they were focused on immediate physical protection, ritual hygiene, managing the absolute terrors of ancient agrarian life.
Ah, right. Unchecked disease, snake bites, natural disasters.
Exactly. They were practical, everyday tools.
So they were basically the ancient Indian equivalent of an emergency first aid kit, well before they were elevated to the status of, you know, esoteric high magic.
That's a perfect way to put it. Correct. But as centuries passed and these texts spread along the trade routes across Asia, reaching into Nepal, Central Asia, China, Japan, and Indonesia, the communities relying on them began to treat them with immense reverence.
They became sacred objects in their own right.
They did, and people started to build elaborate tantric frameworks around the texts themselves. A perfect modern parallel is visible today in the Kathmandu Valley.
Oh, with the newer Buddhists.
Yes.
Yeah.
The newer Buddhists still actively use these five texts in vernacular everyday rites. They stage annual public rituals for highly pragmatic purposes.
Like asking for good weather or protection from illness.
Exactly. But when they do so, they propitiate the five protectresses using a complex five-section manhala and deeply tantric visualization practices.
Practices that are nowhere to be found in the original words of the scripture.
None of it is in the original text. So when the Tibetan redactors were compiling the Kangyur in the centuries following the initial translation, they looked at how the texts were actively being used by living practitioners.
Which was highly tantric.
Right. And so they classified them accordingly as Kriya Tantra.
That context completely reframes how we should read this. I mean, it forces us to bridge the gap between the lofty philosophical heights of Buddhist emptiness and the immediate terrifying reality of a farmer or a monk just trying to survive the night.
It really brings the cosmos down to the dirt.
It does. And to really grasp how it does that, we need to step into the narrative frame of the sutra itself. We begin in the Jetavana on the Thapitas Grove in the ancient city of Sarvasti.
The physical setting here is doing a lot of heavy lifting for the ancient listener. Jetavana was essentially the first permanent Buddhist monastery.
Anathapiyata was a deeply devoted, wealthy merchant, wasn't he?
He was. And he purchased this sanctuary by literally covering the ground of the park with gold coins. It was an act of extreme generosity to provide a safe haven for the Buddha and the Sangha.
But we have to remember why they needed a haven in the first place. This grove was primarily used during the monsoon season. And the Indian monsoon isn't just a heavy rain. It's a profound disruption of reality. It's months of torrential flooding, impenetrable mud, and an absolute explosion of biological life. Travel was basically impossible.
The monks were confined to this space while the jungle around them became fiercely dangerous.
Teeming with venomous snakes, lethal insects, waterborne diseases. Mm-hmm. So Jetavana is established from the very first line as a fragile bubble of sanctuary, entirely surrounded by chaotic, threatening forces.
And into this fragile earthly sanctuary arrives an entourage of almost incomprehensible cosmic scale. The text describes the Buddha being visited by Brahma, the master of the Saha world.
And in Buddhist cosmology, the Saha world is our universe, right? A place defined by the necessity of enduring suffering.
Yes, and Brahma is accompanied by the gods of his realm. But it doesn't stop there. Shukra, the lord of the gods from the heaven of the 33, descends.
The four great kings who guard the cardinal directions of the world arrive.
28 great Yaka generals. These fearsome nature spirits materialize, alongside the complex spirit Hariti with her children and servants.
I mean, this is the heavy artillery of the ancient Indian cosmos gathering in a monsoon-soaked grove. It's a cosmic summit meeting.
It really is. And Brahma, acting as the spokesperson, steps forward to make a highly specific request. He begins by stating his own jurisdiction.
Tending his credentials.
Exactly. He says, "I rule as Lord over the realms of the Chiliocosm."
A chiliocosm is a specific cosmological unit, isn't it? It represents 1,000 worlds.
Right. So Brahma is establishing his immense authority. He notes that he guards, protects, and brings peace to this vast domain.
But then he turns to the Buddha.
Yes, addressing him as the bliss-gone Dharma sovereign and makes a comparison that shifts the entire scale of the narrative. Brahma points out that the Buddha rules over a great trikiliocosm.
This is where we need to pause and define the sheer mathematical awe of Mahayana cosmology.
It's mind-boggling.
Because if a chiliocosm is 1,000 worlds, a great chiliocosm is 1,000 to the power of 3, 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000.
That is 1 billion worlds.
1 billion worlds. Brahma, the creator deity of ancient Indian thought, is humbly acknowledging that his realm of 1,000 worlds is a mere speck compared to the Buddha's domain of spiritual influence.
And the request Brahma makes is born directly from this realization. He essentially asks the Buddha, "Because your domain is infinitely larger than mine, I request you to guard, protect, look after, and bring peace and well-being to this unimaginably vast realm."
And the Buddha's response to this unimaginably vast request is, I think, one of the most striking moments in the sutra.
Oh, absolutely.
Brahma has just asked him to formally take up the protection of 1 billion worlds. And the Buddha doesn't deliver a booming, sky-shaking speech. He doesn't perform a blinding miracle.
No.
He acquiesces by remaining completely, utterly silent. And Brahma, perfectly understanding the weight of this silence, is satisfied and simply vanishes.
The mechanics of that silence are profound. In the ancient Indian philosophical context, speech is an action. It's an exertion of energy, often required to negotiate, convince, or assert dominance.
Right.
By not needing to speak, the Buddha demonstrates a sovereignty that transcends exertion. His silence isn't a lack of an answer. It is an active, immovable confirmation. It is a space completely full of presence and absolute authority.
You know, if we look at modern communication, whether in corporate leadership, politics, or just a text thread with a friend, silence is almost universally interpreted as an absence.
We view it as a lack of action.
Yeah, a sign of avoidance or a failure to respond. We are terrified of dead air. But the sutra is teaching us that from a place of true awakening, silence is the heaviest, most powerful action one can take.
It's a complete energetic seal on the agreement.
Following that silent confirmation, the narrative shifts back to the human scale. The Buddha turns to his monks, recounts the celestial summit, and gives a direct instruction to his closest attendant, Ananda.
He says, "Andanan, you are to receive, hold, recite, preach, and master this queen of incantations."
This is the pivotal moment of transmission. The Buddha has agreed to protect a billion worlds, but he is placing the actual tool to enact that protection directly into human hands.
Which brings us to the actual mechanics of this esoteric survival manual. How did ancient practitioners believe this protection actually worked?
Right. The text describes what we can call an architecture of protection, and the foundational act is upholding the text.
And this isn't just owning a physical copy of the manuscript.
No. Upholding means memorizing it, reciting it aloud, and mastering its meaning. By doing this, the practitioner creates a literal boundary. The Buddha explicitly states, "I will form a boundary 1 league in all the cardinal and intermediate directions."
A league, depending on the specific ancient metric, is roughly 3 to 4 miles. Imagine a lone practitioner reciting these words and through the sheer sonic vibration of the syllables.
And the karmic weight of the truth contained within them.
Exactly. Generating an impenetrable multi-mile force field. And the ancient logic behind this wasn't purely metaphorical.
No, in a worldview where the physical and spiritual realms were deeply intertwined, the vibration of the Sanskrit or translated Tibetan syllables was believed to literally rearrange the energetic fabric of the local environment. It was an active deterrent.
The sutra is painstakingly specific about what this sonic force field keeps out too. It starts with the 404 sicknesses.
And this wasn't just a random number. It points directly to the foundational medical science of the time.
Yes, the 404 sicknesses refer to the ancient Ayurvedic medical model. Ayurveda posited that the human body was governed by basic elements or humors, wind, bile, and phlegm.
A healthy body maintained these in balance.
Right. Disease occurred when they fell out of balance. The medical text categorized 101 diseases caused by a disruption of wind, 101 caused by bile, 101 caused by phlegm.
And crucially, a final 101 diseases caused by a combination of these, or by the direct interference of external demonic forces.
So the sutra is declaring that the boundary neutralizes all 4 categories, providing complete medical coverage.
But it goes far beyond physical illness. The boundary protects the practitioner against kings and ministers.
Which in the modern world might sound like a plea to avoid a tax audit.
Yeah. But in the ancient world, kings and ministers represented the terrifying reality of arbitrary corporal punishment, unjust imprisonment, and the sudden confiscation of everything you owned.
The boundary also keeps out robbers, fire, and water, which is a direct nod to the monsoon floods.
What is particularly beautiful is how the text extends its protection to the most ordinary, embarrassing human failings. It promises to protect you if you are lost in the wilderness, if you are attacked while asleep and vulnerable, or even if you are drunk, reckless, or careless.
The profound compassion in that detail is staggering. It acknowledges that human suffering isn't always the result of some grand cosmic battle between good and evil.
Sometimes suffering is just losing your way on a dark road.
Or making a foolish, dangerous mistake because you've had too much to drink. The Dharma isn't waiting for you to be perfect to protect you. It is there to shield you in your moments of utmost vulnerability and mundane stupidity.
To understand why a spoken incantation could protect against a wild animal, a flood, or a disease, we have to transition into the sutra's highly detailed taxonomy of the unseen world.
This text maps out a complex psychological and spiritual landscape.
The underlying premise is that a vast amount of human misfortune, especially sudden fevers, mental illness, and bad luck, is the direct result of animosity from non-human entities who literally feed on human vitality.
Let's explore that map, because the names and descriptions of these entities are fascinating. They tell us exactly what ancient people were afraid of.
The Buddha systematically lists the intricate hierarchy of these spirits. And the brilliant maneuver here is that by invoking them and calling them by their true names, the Buddha isn't attacking them.
He is subordinating them. He is drafting them into the service of the Dharma.
The act of naming an entity in ancient esoteric traditions is an act of ultimate control, right?
Absolutely. If you know a spirit's true name and its lineage, you strip away its anonymity and bind it to the rules of the cosmos. The text begins at the top of the administrative hierarchy, listing the associates of the four great kings.
Their names are highly auspicious. Friend to all, complete, glory of joy. Knowing their names provides a blanket protection from humans and non-humans alike.
Then the text drops a very specific name, Swift Hand. He is identified as the older brother of Vajrapa, residing in a city called Kakravalapur.
Vajrapani is a massive figure in Buddhist iconography, the fierce protector who wields the thunderbolt.
By invoking his older brother, the text is essentially pulling rank. It's calling in familial authority, telling any hostile spirits in the area that the practitioner is under the direct protection of the heavyweights.
From the divine administrators, the text descends into the realm of the Rakshas.
In general Indian mythology, a Rakshasi is a fierce, often flesh-eating female demon associated with wilderness and danger. But the sutra completely subverts this expectation.
It lists 14 great Rakshasas who are explicitly identified as protectors. In fact, they are the entities who protected the infant Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, while he was in his mother's womb during his birth and throughout his vulnerable childhood.
The names of these protector Rakshasis are incredible. You have names that sound conventionally protective, like powerful or stainless.
But then you have names that are deeply unsettling. Terrifying Lady, Voice of Jambu, and Conflict Lover.
The inclusion of a protective spirit named Conflict Lover, guarding a baby Buddha, is deeply profound.
It really makes you think.
It suggests that fierce, aggressive, and even chaotic energies are not inherently evil. Within the framework of the Dharma, the energy of conflict can be harnessed, refined, and directed towards supreme good.
In this case, aggressively defending the ultimate source of peace. But not all the entities listed are easily converted. The text moves into the darker corners of the taxonomy. It names 8 Rasis who specifically steal vitality from humans, whether the human is awake or asleep.
Their names are purely psychological, slanderous, and instigator of evil.
Think about the mechanics of slander and the instigation of evil within a community. What do those actions actually do?
They steal the vitality of the group. They cause stress, paranoia, and the breakdown of social bonds.
Which physically drains the individuals involved. The ancient world personified these destructive social forces as predatory demons.
And the physical threats get even more visceral. The text warns of 7 Rakshasis who can travel 100 miles the instant they catch the scent of blood.
It describes Mahakali, a terrifying entity with 1,000 sons who lives at the seashore and travels 80,000 miles in a single night.
And it names 5 Rakshasis who, alongside millions of Yakas, roam our world, the Jambu continent. Their names include Always Insane, Further Insane, and Bloated with Power.
The sutra uses the secret mantra to command all these chaotic forces to desist from harm. The incantation is said to cause intoxication, paralysis, and stupefaction in these hostile spirits.
It binds their hands, their feet, their minds, and their tongues.
I can easily imagine a modern listener hearing this roll call of monsters, Always Insane, the blood scent trackers, the vitality stealers, and experiencing a bit of cognitive whiplash.
Oh, for sure. It sounds like pure mythological fantasy.
How does someone living today reconcile this literal subjugation of demons with the internal, highly psychological path of Buddhist awakening that we usually read about?
It requires us to read the text with dual vision. On the historical pragmatic level, for a community living in the 9th century without germ theory or antibiotics, this was literal.
Always Insane wasn't a poetic metaphor for a bad mood.
No, it was the exact diagnosis of the demon causing a sudden violent fever or a psychotic break. The boundary drawn by the sutra was a literal perimeter defense, keeping out actual fatal disease.
But the internal psychological reading is just as valid and entirely supported by the Mahayana framework.
Precisely. To achieve the awakening of Buddhahood, a practitioner must maintain pure conduct. You cannot meditate. You cannot cultivate deep compassion if you are completely consumed by the vitality-stealing forces of anxiety, slander, conflict, or the insanity of endless desire.
Right.
When the sutra talks about the mantra intoxicating and paralyzing the demons, allegorically, this is the internal practice of stopping the momentum of your own karmic obstacles. You are casting a spell to paralyze your own deeply ingrained habits of anger, ignorance, and self-sabotage so that your mind can rest in a sanctified space.
The demons aren't just out there in the ancient monsoon jungle. They are right here inside our own nervous systems, constantly draining our vitality.
Exactly.
And speaking of calming immense chaotic forces, the sutra illustrates this power with an incredible narrative sequence involving Rahu and the moon.
This sequence incorporates a massive piece of ancient Vedic lore. Rahu is the personification of the eclipse.
According to the myth, Rahu is the severed head of an asura, a titan, who endlessly chases the sun and the moon across the sky.
Eclipses occur when Rahu catches them and temporarily swallows them, blotting out the light of the world. It is the ultimate symbol of primordial terror and cosmic disruption.
The sutra uses this visceral terror to demonstrate the absolute supremacy of the Buddha. Let me share a direct translation of the verse from the text. It reads, "Since in the world it is the bliss-gon arhats, to whom the moon goes for refuge, Buddhas, with compassion for the world, free the moon from Rahu."
And then the Buddha doesn't offer a philosophical platitude. He directly addresses the demon of the eclipse.
He issues a command. The Buddha says, "Rahu, the moon dispels darkness, illuminating the sky. Instead of seizing it in the sky, instantly release the lantern of creatures."
The reaction of Rahu is the core of the teaching here. The text describes the demon releasing the moon immediately, but he doesn't just let it go. His physical reaction is extreme.
Rahu is described as trembling, sweating like a sick person.
When another deity asks him why he released his prey so suddenly, Rahu confesses that if he had ignored the Buddha's verse, his head would crack into 7 pieces.
The entity that swallows the stars is terrified into submission. But notice how the Buddha defeats him.
He doesn't forge a cosmic weapon.
He doesn't strike Rahu with a thunderbolt. He simply speaks the truth. He reminds Rahu of the moon's fundamental nature, that it is the lantern of creatures meant to dispel darkness.
The mere utterance of absolute truth by an awakened being is so dense, so heavy with reality, that it physically overwhelms the demon of darkness.
This is a classic example of a paritta, a protection verse. It's an ancient motif used to show that taking refuge in the Buddha is the ultimate defense against even the most terrifying, physics-defying forces of chaos.
You defeat the dark not by fighting it, but by illuminating the truth.
Which perfectly sets up what might be the most shocking contrast in the entire text. We are deep in a sutra filled with aggressive, paralyzing mantras meant to subjugate flesh-eating spirits, disease demons, and the literal cause of solar eclipses.
But when the Buddha identifies the supreme power, the ultimate magic, he pours to something entirely quiet.
Another quote from the text, "Patience is the supreme austerity. Patience is the supreme nirvaluha, so proclaims the Buddha. As for the ordained who harm others, one who is violent toward others is not a proper renunciant."
This verse is the anchor that prevents the practitioner from misusing the entire text. It is very easy to read a text full of spells that paralyze and intoxicate enemies and view it as a weapon of aggression.
The Buddha is clearly stating that these mantras are tools to construct boundaries of peace, not weapons of war.
In a world overrun by literal and metaphorical demons, the absolute supreme austerity is patience. If you respond to a vitality-stealing spirit or a toxic coworker or an online troll with violence or hatred, you have instantly lost the plot.
You are no longer a proper renunciant, because you have allowed the chaos to infect you. Nonviolence is the ultimate magic.
The mechanism by which this nonviolent magic works is detailed in the next major section of the sutra, relying on a concept called Satyakya Kriya, which translates to declarations of truth.
The fundamental idea is that you invoke absolute protection simply by declaring things that are undeniably true.
The text provides a sequence of these declarations to be spoken aloud. It declares that the thus gone one, meaning the fully enlightened Buddha, is supreme among all beings, whether they have no feet, 2 feet, or many feet.
It declares that freedom from attachment is supreme among all phenomena, and it states that the Sangha of Shravakas is supreme among all assemblies.
Let's define Shravakas to ensure the context is clear. The term literally means hearers.
It refers to the early historical disciples who directly heard the Buddha's teachings
and practiced them to attain liberation, becoming arhats, those who have extinguished all defilements. The underlying logic of the Satyagraha is pure causality.
In Buddhist thought, suffering enters through ignorance and illusion. A lie or a distortion of reality creates a vulnerability.
It is a crack in your psychic armor where a demon or a neurosis can slip in, but fundamental reality is impenetrable.
The truth of the Buddha's awakening, or the absolute fact that freedom from attachment ends suffering, cannot be argued with or corrupted. By verbally declaring these truths, you are aligning your mind and your environment with the unshakable bedrock of the universe.
The sutra then applies this declaration of truth in a way that feels incredibly human and touching. It invokes the true words of the Buddha's greatest historical disciples, the elders.
It reads like a catalog of legendary heroes, but instead of praising how many enemies they defeated in battle, it turns their spiritual virtues into literal shields.
It invokes Mahakashapa, identifying his truth as being supreme among those with few desires.
It calls upon Sharadvatiputra, whose absolute reality is being supreme with great wisdom and eloquence.
It names Mahamudgalyana, supreme with miraculous powers. And it invokes Pitsolavaradvaja, supreme among those who proclaimed the lion's roar.
Which refers to the fearless proclamation of the Dharma.
The brilliance of this passage is how it grounds esoteric magic in historical ethics. The text explicitly says, by the truth and true words of these elders, may the person be guarded, protected, looked after.
The magic spell isn't just a string of mystical syllables. It is the lived reality of an enlightened human being.
Mahakashapa's ability to live with few desires is, structurally, the exact opposite of the chaotic, grasping energy of a vitality-stealing demon. His virtue neutralizes their venom.
To really appreciate the depth of how these ancient tools were crafted and transmitted, we need to look at the language itself. We mentioned earlier that the reconstructed Sanskrit title is Mahamantranuttarin Sutra.
The linguistics here offer a masterclass in how these texts evolve as living traditions. The Sanskrit reconstruction comes from the root anu combined with the verb du, which means to hold or maintain.
So it translates cleanly to great upholder of the secret mantra.
But when scholars look at the extant Sanskrit manuscripts from Nepal and India, the goddess or entity associated with this specific text is almost universally named Mahamantranusari.
And what does Anusaran mean, and how does it change the flavor of the text?
Anusarian translates closer to follower. So we have a profound nuance. Does the title refer to a divine entity who upholds and preserves the mantra, like a guardian holding a shield?
Or does it refer to a goddess who follows the path laid out by the mantra?
To complicate it further, the word dadan itself is a technical term. It means an incantation, but literally translates to a campaigner, a string of syllables meant to hold or contain the mind steady in a state of realization.
Is the title referring to a goddess at all, or is it referring to the dadan itself as a container that is triggered by the secret mantra?
It's as if the title is a linguistic prism. Depending on the angle you view it from, whether you are a Tibetan translator in the 9th century, a newer priest in the 15th century, or an English translator today, it refracts a slightly different meaning.
The Dharma Chakra Translation Committee brilliantly noted that committing to just one rigid interpretation would be tantamount to redacting the text's rich history.
The ambiguity isn't a mistake. It's a feature of a tradition that refuses to be locked in a museum display case.
Another linguistic detail that really brings the ancient world to life is the description of the Putanas. When we talked about the taxonomy of spirits, the Putanas were listed as a specific class of disease-causing entities associated with cemeteries.
The translation notes for the Putanas provide a shockingly visceral detail. The Tibetan term used is srulpo, and the Sanskrit is puta. Both heavily imply something putrid or foul-smelling.
The ancient texts associate these spirits with the distinct acrid smell of a billy goat or a crow. They are blamed for causing fevers, violent vomiting, and festering wounds.
This is essentially ancient germ theory. Before microscopes could reveal bacteria, humans understood that foul smells, miasmas from rotting matter or stagnant water, were strongly correlated with disease and infection.
They personify that invisible, foul-smelling threat as a putana.
And to combat an invisible threat, you use an invisible defense. The sutra talks about the Buddha speaking 10 roots of seeds and 10 root words of seeds.
These are the literal sonic syllables of the mantra. It is not just about intellectually understanding the concept of patience. It is about the physical vibration of the spoken truth, pushing back against the invisible miasma of the diseased spirit.
So bringing all these vast threads together, the cosmology, the demons, the linguistics, and the philosophy. What is the ultimate takeaway of this scholarly exploration?
We are looking at a document that operates flawlessly on three distinct levels simultaneously. First, it is a communal public health manual offering literal psychological comfort and perceived physical protection to ancient communities utterly at the mercy of disease, floods, and violent kings.
Second, it is a sophisticated map of the ancient Indian psychological landscape, choosing to personify our internal chaotic drives, our desires, our anger, our tendency towards slander as external monsters that must be paralyzed.
And third, on the highest level, it is a sweeping, profound Mahayana statement on the absolute supremacy of the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
The act of drawing a boundary by upholding this text is not merely about keeping physical sickness at bay. It is about actively creating a safe, sanctified psychological space where your mind can finally be free of desire, anger, and ignorance.
Because if those three poisons are absent, suffering has no soil in which to take root.
If we pull this directly into the present moment, the relevance to our daily practice is undeniable. We might not believe in a literal rakshasa traveling 80,000 miles a night to seal our blood, but every single one of us knows exactly what it feels like to have our vitality violently drained.
We know the absolute paralysis of chronic stress and digital overload. We see the spirits of slanderous and instigator of evil operating at maximum capacity every single day in our societal animosity, our politics, and our online echo chambers.
We do daily battle with our own internal rakshasas of anxiety, distraction, and self-doubt.
And the remedy offered by the great upholder of the secret mantra is incredibly clear. The act of upholding true words. By actively grounding yourself in the undeniable truths of the Dharma, whether that is the supremacy of freedom from attachment or the unshakable power of patience, you build an internal boundary.
You ground your nervous system in absolute reality.
The ultimate defense against chaotic anxiety isn't fighting back with more chaos, it's anchoring yourself in undeniable truth. Just as the Buddha's silence was a cosmos-shifting action that secured a billion worlds, your patient, nonviolent presence in the face of modern insanity can intoxicate and paralyze the chaotic forces around you.
You don't fight the demons. You simply uphold the truth, and the demons break against it.
You don't just draw the boundary. Through your practice and your patience, you become the boundary.
That is an incredibly powerful place to wrap up our lecture today.
I want to sincerely thank you for joining us in this deliberate contemplative space. It is a rare gift to be able to slow down and really let these ancient survival manuals speak to our modern condition. As we close, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building directly on the imagery we've explored.
It's an important reflection.
We talked about that striking sequence where the Buddha frees the moon from the terrifying eclipse demon, Rahu. He doesn't strike the demon with a weapon. He simply speaks a verse of truth, a reminder of the moon's nature as a lantern.
And that mere utterance of truth causes the demon to release the light out of pure awe and terror, sweating and trembling, afraid his head will split into pieces.
So here's the question to take with you into your week. In your own life, what is the Rahu that temporarily eclipses your clarity, your peace, or your vitality? What is the force that swallows your light?
And more importantly, what true word, what fundamental, unshakable truth can you practice upholding to force that darkness to release its grip, allowing your own natural light to shine once again?
Thank you to the 84,000 Project for bringing these words to light, and thank you for your dedication to study. Be well, and may your boundaries hold strong.
Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from BodyArchive.org.